I think radio is declining in its relevance. It's not dead, but it's headed that way.
Why is that? Why do you think that's happening?
Well, too many commercials, limited playlists, and the options to choose your own music when you want to choose it on the streaming services. Yeah. And there are older people, meaning 50 and up, who still remember great radio and listen to it and like it. Probably not the commercials, but they're just used to it. It's a habitual. Mm-hmm. Under 50, though, it's really tough. You talk to somebody 15 or 20, if they even have a radio, and they don't.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. That is Lee Abrams. He founded XM Satellite Radio and they created the rock format for FM radio, just that kind of stuff. A legend in radio, especially. We're going to get to him in just a second. Before we get to that, I'm touring with my Broadway show, Permission to Speak. I'm going to be November 11th in New Jersey at the Pollock Theater, November 18th in Skokie, Illinois, December 29th in Orlando, Florida, February 2nd, Sellersville, Pennsylvania, March 9th. Going to be at the United Theater in Westerly, and I'm doing stand-up December 1st at the Kansas City Record Bar, and December 15th, 16th, I am going to be at the House of Comedy in Minnesota. Come on out. It's all on my website, paulmercurio.com. Hope you can make it. Please come see the Broadway show. It's really cool, really different, really excited about it. Frank Oz is directing it. What more do you need? Just come. Before we get to that, the pressure of getting a good Uber rating, I'm 4.4 because I had a couple of arguments with some jerks driving me, and I'm trying to get it up. So I'm forcing myself to be nice in the car. So my standard go-to is, you busy today? And I always feel like that's enough to get 5 stars. I probably should do more, but I don't have it in me because even that's fake. I don't care if he's busy. I don't want to talk. But I'm trying to be nice because I need my rating to get up because I don't want to get bounced. This is where I am right now. I'm already self-conscious and need approval. Obviously, I'm a comedian. As I like to say, if my mother hugged me 2 more times, I wouldn't be doing this. But now it's Uber drivers. Something's wrong. And I also feel like I have to tip them because if I feel like they wait for me to tip them. And then if I don't tip them, I get a lower rating. So I feel like I'm being extorted. It's not good. I'm going to ride a bike everywhere. Screw it. All right. Lee Abrams coming up. Great conversation with him. Enjoy it and hope to see you out on the road at Permission to Speak, my Broadway show or my stand-up shows. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very special guest this week. If you are living, this man has influenced your life. If you listen to radio, if you listen to satellite radio, if you watch news, if you read a newspaper, in any way, this gentleman has had some impact on your life. Ladies and gentlemen, God. No. I welcome Lee Abrams, a brilliant businessman, entrepreneur, media consultant. Just a few of the highlights for Lee before we jump into our conversation. He created the Rock FM format, you know, just something little, designed programming and was at the forefront of satellite radio in helping build, create, and foster XM satellite radio. And he's advised everyone from Rolling Stone magazine to the Tribune Holdings and more. And he's worked with some minor artists like, you know, Iron Maiden and Yes, you know, a real underachiever. Lee Abrams, everybody. Welcome, Lee.
Great to be here. Yeah, appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to talk to you about. And I want to start as a jumping off point about satellite radio.
Okay.
You also created, you know, the FM format, you know, but before we get to that, you were the chief programming officer for XM Satellite, which then merged with Sirius. It seems like the world of radio went from, it was AM, then FM was the thing. And then from FM, we went to satellite. Talk about those early days, how exciting that was, that you guys were kind of saying, okay, let's what's the next big thing? Why did you feel like satellite radio was something that was needed, or if needed isn't the right word, appropriate at the time? How do you do that? Like, how do it's just the idea of creating another radio consumption format to me just is mind blowing. You know, walk us through those early days and the fun of it, the scary parts of it, what was exciting about it, all of that.
Yeah, it was an amazing time. It was magical. We had the opportunity to really reinvent radio. In fact, the mandate was create radio that is so good people will pay for it. And to do that, it had to be clearly different and hopefully better. And we had a blank canvas. We were able to handpick just an amazing team. Out of every 100 people we talked to, 99 didn't get it. But there'd be that one who thought, yeah, now I can do radio for the reasons I got into it in the first place. Creativity, evolution, open mind, anything goes.
For every 100 you talked to, the 99 didn't get it, but one did. What was it? You're talking about the on-air talent, the business side of FM radio. Who wasn't getting it and why weren't they getting it?
No, we were hiring programming people, which were program directors, production mm-hmm. people, sound and sound imagineers, and disc jockeys. And, you know, a lot of people thought, well, there's nothing wrong with radio. You know, I got a good job. Then there'd be another person who said, oh, no, radio's all screwed up. This is an opportunity to really, really advance the medium. And so, you know, it was a blank canvas. And we had these boot camps, which were, we did dozens of them, which took the staff, usually offsite, and really re-educated them, cleansed them from everything they ever learned about radio, and retaught them the XM way. And it sounds, oh, God, you know, boot camp. Now it was wonderful. It was liberating for these people. And again, we hired people who wanted to be liberated. And we had a cliche buzzer. If anybody came up with a cliche, they got buzzed and three times and they were fired. So that, nobody was fired, but that got the message across real quick that we weren't doing funny morning shows with a female news kick,
that kind of stuff. Yeah,
Two for Tuesdays, which was great in 1973, but this was decades later, and so we really had a creative thing going where people were able to really rethink radio within the framework of the XM mission that we created.
What were some of the bad habits that you had to break people of from that world of radio? Because like you said, you know, 73, cutting edge, what you're doing in FM, you're not doing in AM, you're breaking the mold. But then as time goes on, people sort of, human nature, you lapse into just the same old, same old, same old, right? And you don't get creative. And so what did you have to break people of? And how did you see satellite being able to be this liberating experience for them?
Well, satellite was the liberating experience because that was our mandate. Let's fix radio. Let's create a whole new sound. And some of the things that we had to cleanse out of people were these ridiculous rules about playlists, that they had to be a certain size. We had short playlist formats. We had one channel which just played the 20 top songs over and over again for younger people. That's all they wanted to hear. But we also had reggae channels, jazz channels, blues channels. And within, let's say rock, for example, we had a format that was just played the top tracks if you did want to hear Bohemian Rhapsody every day. But then we had deep tracks, which really was reminiscent of the early freeform days where you could hear anything. Then we had the loft, which was kind of a mellow rock. We had fine tuning, which was progressive rock, where you'd hear 10-minute King Crimson songs and Fish, and we had a metal, liquid metal, which was just hardcore badass metal, and we had the Boneyard, which was more just hard rock, Aerosmith and Van Halen. So we had all these opportunities to create niches within these major genres. Same thing in country, same thing even in classical. We had serious classical stations, and we had more pop classical stations. So freeing people of the rule book, the playbook that had been developed in the 70s and 80s was real important. On DJs, little things like talking over the music so you could hit the vocal. DJs thought, wow, how impressive, and impressed each other. But the audience said, shut the fuck up, play the music. I don't want to hear the beginning of the song.
Yeah.
Things like that. And production-wise, radio stations were still using Star Wars sound effects. Pew, pew, laser and big voices. No, we got to create theater of the mind, take people on a voyage, a sonic voyage with our production. So we broke away from all those goofy-sounding cliches and slogans. You know, back in the 80s, it seemed like every rock station was, you know, re-rock harder. And I mean, it was just so cheesy, so cliche.
Well, it's funny, you know, I have this thing about sport. Like, I like to listen to sports talk radio, right? Every single station has figured out that any voiceover has to be, you're listening to the Sports Hub 92.7. We, you know, and it's like, I don't know that it's so old school to me. I don't get that. And even like ESPN, they have whoever, when they bump to commercials, there's that one guy who talk, this is brought to you by Chick-fil-A. And it's just this weird forced, like testosterone driven programming.
Yeah.
Choice. I don't.
We tried to get people out of announcing and just talk. And there were different tempos. And some of the channels had no disc jockeys. For example, we had an environmental channel, which was just really chill music. Mm-hmm. And, why have a disc jockey? That'll just interrupt the
right.
flow. Other channels were intense in that, like our 60s channel, we tried to replicate top 40 radio in the 60s, even with the reverb and the old jingles. We wanted to take people on a mind trip that took them back to 1965. And that station, it had a real top 40 energy that is really, by today's standards, kind of goofy. But if you lived through the 60s, it was the radio you grew up with. And some channels, you know, were very, very mellow. Some were in your face. Our metal channel was certainly in your face. So it was great to have different styles, each one with the idea of revolutionizing things, breaking away from the cliches and creating a whole new sound. And again, with the people, they got it. They learned the XM mission, then put their own touches on it. And the result was really some fantastic channels.
Yeah, I mean, the environmental channel sounds like you could just have like a track of birds chirping and that could be cool for people, right? Right, like anything, right?
Those are birds chirping. We heard from the Blue Jays and Cardinals, you know. None of that.
6:36. Let's get some traffic. did you like? So you know, this reminds me of, I don't know why. So I was one of the original writers on The Daily Show, and this is before when Comedy Central was like now Comedy Central, right? So there was, it was a smaller network, and there was, you could, they just like, we were literally kids down in the basement with a chemistry set, and they'd let us try things, and then we'd get yelled at because we went too far with jokes, and the Doug Herzog, the president of the network, would come in and yell at us on a Friday, like your dad yells at you for like, what were you thinking of doing with the thing? But he would yell at you with like a smile on his face because he kind of wanted us to push, you know?
Right.
And the creative freedom, and you must have been like kids in a sandbox, right? Just like whatever you want. It was a completely blank canvas for you. It's amazing.
Yeah, we had a blueprint for the mechanics of the thing. But as far as the music and the disc jockeys, it was all controlled insanity. It was definitely insane, but very controlled and organized.
Do you remember, like, sort of, I know the kind of talent that you were drawn, Quincy Jones, B.B. King, Willie Nelson, Snoop Dogg, Tom Petty, to bring them into the fold, were some easier to work with than others? Were there just moments you look back and just laugh and go, or did you have some nights or days where you're like, what's going on? You're banging your head against the wall. Like, I can imagine there's some fun stories from behind the scenes a little bit.
Yeah, actually, most of those experiences were great. I mean, Bob Dylan was unbelievable. Of course, you had to give him a lot of freedom. We're not going to slap a format on Bob Dylan.
And he was unbelievable in what sense?
Oh, first of all, it was him, you know, the greatest poet of the 20th century. But he really put thought into it and had a show called Theme Time Radio Hour, where every week was a different theme. So it might be trains one day, and he'd play all these train songs in his, you know, inimitable style, talk about it and how it influenced him. And that was great. Tom Petty, too. Petty really played his personal record collection. It was great. You'd hear anything from Runaway by Del Shannon to just some bizarre Americana song. He just played, you know, his record library. Snoop was, well, he had a posse. That was a little more difficult, but you know,
you had to negotiate all those people around him and everything else.
Yeah, Quincy Jones is great just because he's Quincy Jones and has so many stories. And we did a lot of special programs with him. We did Bebop to Hip Hop, where he talked about R&B music and its roots and where it is now. And again, the stories he has. He produced everybody from Michael Jackson and to Frank Sinatra to Duke Ellington he was with. And so really those artist shows were handpicked because everybody wanted a show. And, you know, realistically, a lot of people couldn't handle it. But the ones that we were able to sign and talk to and explain it and were just fantastic.
So it wasn't a tough sell for some of the artists because, you know, again, it's a new, I mean, obviously, look, if you put money on the table, I'm sure anybody will do anything. I remember vaguely like sort of, you know, big artists were getting paid well to do it, but still like, were there any that were, yeah, I don't know, I'm going to, this is something new, not for me, or let me see how it plays out first. And then maybe I'll jump in the pool. Did you get any of that?
Yeah, there was, because we had other artists on our list we would like to do shows with, and we were too young. Bob Dylan was an interesting story, because he never does anything for anybody. He's Bob Dylan. And we tried so hard to get through to him, tried the record company, tried one of his managers, and we finally found a guy, Jeff Rosen, who was his business manager, who said, hey, this is an interesting idea, and he came visited us, I think, to check us out. To see if we were full of it or...
And you're in New York? You're based out of New York at the time?
Washington.
Or Chicago? You're in Washington. Okay, right.
So his manager, Jeff Rosen, flew down and we spent the day and really hit it off. And I think he wanted to check to see if, you know, not if we were legit, but if we were, our heads were in the right place. If this is going to be some commercial Bob Dylan thing. We explained to him, no, this is Bob Dylan's life on radio. And we talked a lot about the old days of those great 50,000 watt stations that Bob would listen to at night from Minnesota. And he met our CEO, who played it great. I was a little afraid he'd go into, you know, what numbers and ROI and all that. He didn't. He said, Bob Dylan, you know. He said,
Yeah.
And so we passed the test. But that was probably the hardest one, just, again, because it's Bob Dylan and he was like this.
Where do you think Dylan, he's so young, but wrote like an old man. I mean, that is a compliment, right? He wrote with such gravitas at such a young age with such, not just soul, but sort of depth of thinking. Did God just touch him with that ability? Like, where does that come from in a person like that, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's spiritual in nature. I think it's a gift people have. And those who really work at it and develop it are the superheroes of music. And I don't think he just one day said, I'm going to write songs. I think it was in his DNA from birth. And and his timing was great because we had the kind of folk boom in the early 60s, and boy, he led that. And
is it
spread out to mass appeal, and he's Bob Dylan. And again, the timelessness of his work, too, is it still sounds as the times they are changing. I listened to that the other day. It's as valid today as it was in 1963 or whenever it came out. So he's a special case.
Yeah. You talk about like, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about like these sort of, you look at different genres of music, whether it's jazz in the 20s, rock in the 50s, punk in the 70s, there's always seemed to be this sort of almost knee-jerk reaction against it. Like, initially labeled as rebellious or dangerous only to become mainstream, right? And you could just see, you know, hip hop, heavy metal. What is that about? Why do you think society has that initial instinctual reaction to something new like that? as being dangerous or not appropriate or whatever, but then embraces it fully.
Yeah, I think it's scary to some people. It even goes as far as, you know, it's satanic. It certainly happened with rock and roll and metal, which is right. ridiculous. But
can't shoot Elvis from the waist down on Ed Sullivan when he's
And one of the things is deals with chronology. I find that the music people like between 16 and 20 is what you like for life. Under 16, whoever's cool or cute. But 16 to 20, the musically formative years, that's when I was in school, people used to get into fist fights over who's better, Jeff Beck or Eric Clapton. You know, it's like...
I remember that conversation, yeah.
You know, a lot of people in that age grasp onto this new sound, and it follows them for life. I remember when I was just starting in radio, there were actually station managers and executives who thought Jimi Hendrix was a fad. You know, it's just some drug-fueled fad that'll go away and we'll get people back to normal music.
With his guitar playing and everything else, I mean, he's another guy you got to put up there with Beck and Eric Clapton.
Oh,
I mean,
it was amazing, right? Yeah. And it was just people just didn't get it. But if you were 16 to 20, mainly in those formative years, that was he was your god. His music was anthems. But it's throughout history. I went back and looked at articles from the 20s and 30s and people arguing about jazz. You know, that's horrible. How can this, this not real music? And so you're always going to have that.
But there's no other art form as we're talking about this, like with comedy, right? I'm a comedian. So like, okay, you had your Borscht Belt guys, your Jackie Masons and your Pat Coopers, right? And then it kind of morphed into sort of the Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, observational, safe comedy. But like, so there's been genre within every art form, whether it's painting, it's the Renaissance, it's the Impressionist. But only with music where things get labeled dangerous. Or what is it about? I mean, you know, it's just a different sense that you're using to consume a piece of art, my ears instead of my eyes, right? Like, so what is that about, you think?
Well, music's a very personal thing. And if you're not part of a generation that likes a certain style, it's just, first of all, it's heavily exposed. So there's a lot of exposure to sounds. But it also, music comes with lifestyle characteristics. Let's go back to the late 60s. Music also meant long hair, generally kind of left-leaning. It meant just an openness. And a lot of people rejected that. I remember if you walked into the wrong bar in 1969 and put on Jimi Hendrix, you could get the shit kicked out of you because that's not music. You know, put on some things.
Or there was a day when, like, you know, the rock stars, like, Seeger's got that line about being on the road. You walk into a bar and you hear the murmur, is that a man or a woman, right? Like the whole long hair thing, right? And the idea that like, you know, rock and rollers in the 70s with the long hair were looked at as, you know, gay or weird or whatever, right? Like now it's nothing to have long. I mean, you know, entrepreneurs, CEOs of tech companies have long hair and man buns, but like, I mean, I just think we live in a culture where if people don't understand something, rather than really try to understand it and embrace it, they flock to other people who don't understand it and form this safe haven of like, yeah, aren't they weird? We're okay. Aren't they? Like, and
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Unhealthy. And I think that's wrong with our culture.
Disco was a great example of that. Talk about divisive. But it was never really a, you know, racial or gay thing. The thing that rockers didn't like about disco was several things. One, they were used to real guitars and sweating drummers. And disco was about electronic music and drum machines. Rockers were about long hair, and discoers were more about, you know, looking sharp.
Yeah.
Rockers were used to a concert, festival seating, jam your way up to the front. Discos, if you didn't look right, the bouncer wouldn't let you in. And there's so many other social reasons behind the anti-disco campaign. And it just looked, it actually offended rockers, which is kind of ridiculous. But
Were you always able to keep an open mind about it? I grew up Italian, right? So my mother had this thing, especially like, she never wanted us to come off like the Guido Italians, like, hey, how you doing, you know, with the chains and the whatever. In fact, one time, a girl I was dating in high school, she gave me the gold chain with the horns, right? With the thing. Right. And my mother saw that. She literally ripped it off my neck. You are not wearing that in this house. So we dressed not like the kind of John Travolta, Guido Italian and Saturday Night Fever, right? So I had this built-in bias against disco music because I think my mother had ingrained in me, like, well, that's what the Guido Italians like. But I have, as later in life, I came to respect it. And like the Bee Gees, I thought it was at the time, you know, it was a little before my time. But when I first heard them, I thought they were a joke, they're whatever. But when you really listen to some of their music and their lyrics, they're legitimate artists like anybody else. It was just an art form that took a while for me to get my head around, you know?
Yeah, it was very, a lot of the music was very well produced. And Bee Gees are a great example. You listen today and the production values and the melodies and the songs are fantastic.
Yeah.
So it was more the disco lifestyle that people didn't, you know, again, rock was about smoking dope. Disco at the time was about drinking champagne and Coke.
And, yeah. I mean, I could see you with your shirt unbuttoned and a couple of gold chains back in the day. Doing a little bit of the whole, like,
many of our clients actually did Disco Demolition, you know, in the name of rock and roll. You probably remember the Chicago event. It was interesting. Some people are like, yeah, right on. Others, you know, it's like burning books, and others were just appalled. How can they blow up records?
Yeah. So what did you see? That was lacking in AM, that FM. So let's step back in time now, the precursor to satellite, right? So AM is AM and you know, around for going back, what, to the 20s, 30s? And then it sounds like, you know, the same thing, right? Well, the precursor to satellite, what was it that was lacking? What did you see as the potential for FM? And then once you got into the world of FM, obviously, like anything, you probably discovered other things that you could do with it or as a result of it that you didn't even see in your mind's eye when you created it.
Yeah, well, FM really started in the 1940s, but didn't take off till the 70s. And the main thing, main vulnerability in FM was sound quality. Because this was a time people were investing in component stereo systems and 8-tracks in their car. And AM sounded terrible playing Led Zeppelin or Jethro Tull. It just, you know, was all kind of muffled. And so the fidelity and also stereo, because stereo was, again, really emerging as a important.
Because AM was mono, meaning if you had two speakers in your car, nothing was separated. It was all just coming in as one signal through both speakers at the same time. Right.
Yeah, so they did have AM stereo for a while, but that was static in two channels. You know, it didn't make any sense.
Right.
But when we created our format, we realized there's a huge audience of AM listeners we call vulnerable top 40 listeners. They listen to the big AM station in New York, would have been WABC. In Chicago, it was WLS or WCFL. And the problem is, these people liked every fourth record they heard on an AM station. They love it when Sunshine of Your Love came on. Then it would be Bread and the Carpenters and Herb Alpert. And, you know, I didn't necessarily hate the music, but didn't really like it. And then would come a Beatles song. They love that. So we decided to create a format geared for the vulnerable top 40 listener. And the way we did that was maintain familiarity, but change the familiarity factor from song to song title. In other words, on top 40, AM top 40 in the 60s, you know every song. What we wanted was you can know every artist, but within that artist, you could play dozens of songs. Because we were finding like somebody be listening to radio, AM radio, and hear Santana, Black Magic Woman. That's all they'd hear. On our channel, you'd be able to hear Black Magic Woman plus dozens of other Santana songs that were familiar by artists. Because the second you heard it, oh, that's that Black Magic Woman group. But it's not Black Magic Woman. Wow, what is this? And then we'd go to Cream and Hendrix. But we'd play the singles, but really focus on the depth of the album. And so what we got was a commercial station that didn't lose its progressive identity. It was progressive, but very accessible. And those kind of formats really couldn't happen on AM. Another thing with AM is a lot of them were really making money and didn't take FM seriously at the time.
How did they look at it? What was their take on it?
Classical music and dentist office music. You can't put rock and roll on FM. Rock belongs on AM Top 40. And surprise, you put it on FM, and within 3 years, AM rock radio is pretty much toast because everybody's listening to FM now. Better fidelity, depth in the music, disc jockeys that were talk to you instead of, hey, everybody, 9 o'clock in the morning, you know. And it was a whole new sound that was just in sync with the era. But the real main two reasons behind FM's success is the fidelity and new formats.
So how did that work from a business standpoint? So there's a WCBS AM radio in New York City, let's say, right? Or I guess maybe it would be WGN in Chicago where you're based out of, right? So like, are you going to the corporations that own these signals for AM and saying, I know it existed in the 40s, but like when it really made its hit in the 70s, how did even that work that new, like 92.3 became a station on my radio dial in my car? Like,
yeah, fascinating. There were a lot of radio stations, FM stations that had these huge signals. And I mean, really loud and powerful, but they were hidden in closets running automation tapes. And so I went to these companies and said, you have a gold mine sitting there in a closet called your AM FM station. And if you mobilize it, you can get probably a 3, 4, 5 share, whatever. And a surprising number of broadcasters sort of said, okay. One main one was Taft Broadcasting at the time, huge company, big company at the time. And make a long story short, I had one station in Raleigh, North Carolina that was a first client, and it went to number one in 90 days. It was just a huge, and it was a perfect market for a big college market and all that. And a rep firm called Crystal, which was an advertising representative for stations around the country, this was one of their clients, and they called me and said, you know, that's a remarkable success story you have down in Raleigh. Would it work in any other markets? I said, hell yeah, it'll work anywhere. But let me introduce you to Carl Wagner of Taft Broadcasting, who is thinking about doing something with his FMs. He doesn't know what. So I talked to Carl Wagner, met him, and did the whole presentation. He said, this is great. I got to convince my general managers at the station level to buy into it. Would you come to our manager meeting in the Key Biscayne? I said, hell yeah. So I went there, and it was funny because this was really the Izod crowd, you know, golf shirts and
right, you know, the yuppies, I guess they would call them at the time. The
and yeah. I had long hair; I really stood out. And there's two things: I did the presentation with the bosses, Carl Wagner's approval, and walked away with four of their stations in Columbus, Buffalo, Kansas City, and Pittsburgh, and that really launched things. But what really sold the thing is I was a tennis player in high school, and they had a golf and a tennis tournament, and you had to be in one of them. So I figured, oh, I'll try the tennis tournament and won it. All of a sudden, I went from this kind of strange, hippie-ish kind of guy to one of them.
Yeah, Did you cut your hair?
Yeah, I cut my hair. It was flying all over the place. But it really softened the blow of some kind of wacky young hippie type entering their corporate world. And then those four stations soared right out of the box. They went to like number one in their market. And that's when the floodgates opened.
So the others in the industry now started to see what Taft was doing. Yeah.
They had successes, solid successes in now five markets. And it was obviously very economical to run. And it was approved by Taft Broadcasting, which is a very conservative company. And a lot of other broadcasters said, well, if it's okay for Taft, it's got to be okay for us. And we signed station after station, and everyone just went to the top, and the domino effect. We just started, you know, market after market.
So for people listening and watching who may not understand, so in order for a signal to exist, you have to get it approved or granted by the FTC, right? So
right.
You're sitting there, you're Taft, you've got this 50,000 watt signal that's sitting in a closet with automated programming you're not using. You obviously went, when you had your lawyers go and get your AM signal, you said, well, we're here, let's get an FM signal. We'll probably use it someday, right? Correct right. me if I'm getting any of this wrong. Why the hell would you just let it sit there and not you? Like, it's like buying a Mercedes and just keep it in your garage and driving it around every other week or something for 5 minutes. Like, what were they waiting for? Not taking nothing away from you and your team and how brilliant you are, but if the people who were at the Tafts of the world were smart enough to create the world of radio and get their signals, didn't they see what they had? How did they
not? Well, Taft Broadcasting did. They were one of the few. That's why that Carl Wagner, who ran the company, said they wanted to do something with their FMs, just didn't know what.
Yeah.
And other companies, though, were like, FM, you know, it's we make all our money in AM. Nobody's ever going to, who cares about the FM? We're raking it in with our AM station. But then when they saw rating success, they said, and revenue success, very important, because there was a perception that people who listen to this channel, this format, would buy waterbeds and, you know, pipes, and that's about it. So once the revenue established in these stations and it started attracting major advertisers because of their 18 to 34 ratings, that's what
right.
I mean, you had ratings and you had revenue. It was like, okay.
And so again, we hit the gold mine. How do you see, you know, you've been part of the music industry, radio, obviously, for decades, but like, you know, we have technology is such a big part of our lives now in politics and then the social dynamics and social media. And how do you see music's role, I guess, in documenting and influencing where we are now, where we go forward? Because it always had a role in society, but society in the 70s and 80s didn't have social media. It didn't have technology changing the way. Look, I work in TV. I think technology runs Hollywood now, not Hollywood, because the way people consume their content is dictating how we make the content and who makes the content and how much it's made and how often it's made. Where do you see music in that?
Well, I think
in that landscape?
I think radio is declining in its relevance. It's not dead, but it's headed that way.
Why is that? Why do you think that's happening?
Well, too many commercials, limited playlists. And the options to choose your own music when you want to choose it on the streaming services. And there are older people, meaning 50 and up, who still remember great radio and listen to it and like it. Probably not the commercials, but they're just used to it. It's a habitual. Under 50, though, it's really tough. You talk to somebody 15 or 20, if they even have a radio, and they don't.
The radio? What's that? Oh, we use that to prop up the sofa. Yeah, my dad, that thing, that box. Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
You know,
yeah.
When we started XM, we did a lot of research to see who would be our customers. And it was amazing to see mainly younger people say, 100 channels of radio, why would I want that? Radio sucks. And we had to explain, no, this is that's the general attitude. And it sucks. And again, the older people who grew up with it, it's part of their lives and they're a little harder to change. But
right.
One of the problems with music is the fragmentation. There's, other than, you know, a few major stars in the Taylor Swift category, it's all over the road. It used to be, you know, a half dozen or a dozen genres. Now there's hundreds of them. And I'm even personally, you know, with Apple Music, I'm discovering all sorts of new things, you know, I'd never hear on the radio. It could be everything from the old Hank Williams song to just some weird progressive rock band. So it's very fragmented. There's no radio used to be a unifier. Boy, it goes on the radio and that artist's career really has a shot. That doesn't happen anymore.
In some ways, it seems like it's harder for an artist to break out, but in other ways, it's easier. It's harder, and I mean this for video content as well, television shows. There's so much content. How do you break out? I can't tell you, like in the last 2 months, I've had three different shows. This is TV for Minute Streaming, recommended to me by people. One was a straight up documentary. The other two were fictional. Well done, whether it was Netflix, Amazon, I don't remember exactly. I mean, that's the point. I can't even remember where I watched it. But more importantly, I saw no advertising for any of these three series that I watched or movies. They were top notch, well done, well executed, top names behind, in front and behind the camera. My point is there's so much content out there. If you're a musician, is it harder or easier? I would think it's easier in some way because you can just be entrepreneurial. And with basic technology, you can make good sounding music and just post it on your website and on social media and hope you hit. But how do you see it right now?
I think it's extremely difficult. First of all, there's so much music out there. A lot of it really isn't great.
Which is slightly- and the same thing with what's streaming on Netflix, Amazon, or whatever. They need to put so much out. The quality is definitely watered down, but go ahead.
Yeah, the quality is definitely watered down. And again, there's no one place to break an artist. You got to get it on all these different platforms, and it's so competitive. Cutting through is it's just really difficult these days.
Yeah.
And again, but it starts with talent. Somebody has talent and a really amazing sound, great production, great melodies, great songs. You know, eventually they can break through. It starts with that. But even there, it's just tough with, you know, again, record companies are eliminating their radio promotion department because it doesn't do any good. So it's tough. I mean, you got to just cut through the clutter and a lot of luck, too. So it's
you have a great newsletter that I read, and there was the one that you did recently about the balance of science, business, and art. And you say the harmonious balance between art, sales, business, and the new digital landscape. It's a really great read and really insightful. And there's the final line, and it's very powerful. You say, we can either seize the opportunity to align ourselves with this new awareness or remain in a state of confusion. Living in omnivision, where all perspectives converge, is the key to navigating this transformative era. I'm finding that, you know, have a podcast, I perform live, I perform on TV, but you also have to have a business sense. And how do you, as we were just saying, there's so much out there. How do you break through the din and the noise? And are people getting what you're saying? What are people missing in that? How do people do that? Because you've also had experience, you know, you've restructured networks. You helped found TNT. You've worked in all form of media as a consultant, as someone that restructures. Like what? How do we strike that balance?
Yeah, it starts with exactly just that, putting equal importance on the creative, the business, the sales, the administration, the technology. Right now, companies tend to be very focused on revenue and the business side of it. And that's great, but great art creates revenue. You know, bad art doesn't. But the artistic approach to media is all but, at least in a lot of cases, is gone.
Well, because it's two things working against each other. It's being risk averse, right? Maximizing shareholder value, but being risk averse at the same time. Look, it's one thing if you're selling toilets, you don't have to be risk averse. A toilet's a toilet and people need to take a shit. So you're pretty good business, right? People are going to buy toilets, right? But when you've decided to go into a business that's highly subjective, you have to be a risk taker in order to really succeed. Otherwise, you're just going to be putting out pablum and the same bullshit, and no one's going to care and no one's going to buy your product. So it's always been like art and commerce have always sort of been fighting each other a little bit, right?
Yeah, they need to merge and become one powerful unit. Apple is probably a good example of that, in that obviously they got their business down. Obviously, they got their technology down. And creatively, they're not very good, in my opinion, at creating programming, but they're outstanding in creating new devices. So yeah. That's one company that seems to be harmonious. Other companies, I won't name names, don't want to hear new ideas. They're either scared of them, or the top guys are just working out their contracts, making a lot of money, and don't want to upset the apple cart. You find a lot of that. They're just so set in their ways. We've always done it this way. We'll continue to. And those are the ones I think are extremely vulnerable. And I see that in television news. You know, that hasn't changed in 40 years. It's just new lipstick and new slogans. But television news, also very conservative business. And I just see a tremendous opportunity in a...
Yeah, talk about what you're doing with that in that area. You've got this sort of new idea that sounds fascinating and really sort of cutting edge in the next generation.
Yeah, it's similar to what we did at XM. Blow up the news playbook. Forget news on television that never existed before. What would it look like? And it probably wouldn't be two chit-chatting anchors behind a fake city skylight in front of a fake skyline with a lower third that's just going back and forth and four pundits yelling at each other.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, hey, that chatter, that little like bit of, whoa, that was quite a dog, wasn't that, Mary? Like that kind of
chit chat. You know, and back to you, Bob. And
exactly.
Talk about cliches. It's much worse than radio. So the idea is really blowing up the playbook and creating a 2024 version of what news can be and make it exciting, energetic. And
how do you do that? What do you, can you talk a little bit about what your vision is for that? How do you do that?
It'll take an hour to go through everything, but the key takeaways are eye, ear, brain, where visually it's stunning. Instead of an anchor or a reporter standing in front of a factory that burned down 6 hours ago, it's just movie-like, big pictures. And so it's visually stunning. Ear, every story has a soundtrack to it. Right now, news music is very percussive. Dun 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 dun, tonight at 10. this is where every story has a soundtrack to it, which elevates the storytelling immeasurably. And that might be, if it's a story about inner city strife, there could be Coltrane type music in there. Just elevates experience. And thirdly is the intellectual scale, the brain. And if you picture a television intellectual scale, if one is, you know, Honey Boo Boo or one of those goofy reality shows, and 10 is Masterpiece Theater, most programming, and makes a lot of money, very successful, and that's great. Let's put it in that 3, 4, 5 range. News, even news, particularly news. And I see the gold being at a 7. Not elite, but just not dumbed down. So it's visually stunning. It has a soundtrack. And it's intelligent. I call it mass appeal intelligent. And again, using Apple, somebody said, what's another mass appeal intelligent story? And I said, Apple. You know, everybody's got one, but they're intelligently designed and packaged and all that.
Right.
And one of the keys is no anchors. There's narration, sort of like the newsreels were in the...
So it's all in VO. It's all in voiceover with some...
There aren't commentators, but a new generation of them. We got one guy who's an ex-felon, ex-gangbanger, and he's cleaned himself up. But man, he's like Andy Rooney on acid. Just really modern and intense. And there are a lot of people like that out there, the next generation of commentators, which are really today. And just the whole format of it really moves along. There's lots of opportunity for people to when there's a story on, people can vote, you know, this is bullshit, this is great. We have an open mic, we'll have a better name for it. This is where anybody can take their phone and talk for a minute about anything they want. We'll filter it, of course, but then we'll show what America's really thinking. And we'll have people who say, go Palestine. Others are Palestine or terrorists. And we'll just have the voice of America, sort of like your own personal talk show. So they're literally, actually, pages and pages of new.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And in a nutshell, it's really more of like a movie than a newscast. It's a movie of the world at the moment. And it really takes you places. If it's a story about, Middle East strife, we might play Egyptian hip hop music. And again, instead of reporters, we'll have just real big scenes of what's going on with narration. So it's a whole new look and sound that I think is time is right, because television news hasn't changed its basic format since the 50s. People behind desks and, you know, back to you, Bob, and news music, da-da-da-da-da-da, percussive.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's funny because the music is, I think you're spot on. You know, we've talked about the show that I have permission to speak, which is people sharing stories from their lives and telling stories. And I think social media has emboldened people in a good way, sometimes a bad way, but in a good way to share who they are. So I love the idea in your reimagination of news that people get to sort of put their opinions in, because they're just as valid as, you know, some guy in pancake makeup that's been doing it for 30 years. And, you know, the average person has a lot of interesting opinions. So it's great to give them that format, because I find in my live show, they come up and they've got some really great perspectives and stories and opinions, and they're just as cogent and well delivered as a professional newscaster, you know.
Yeah.
And they get some really good points across. And then the music part of it is funny, because my director, you know, Frank Oz, is the director of the show. We're working on putting animation into the live show. We have a new set that we built, and we literally last night were working on a music track for the animation, and how important the music help the visual and not just be there for the sake of being there. And the music tells the story along with the visual. And so everything you're saying really resonates in that way with me.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a hit. It's tough because a lot of the traditional news organizations, where this would be perfect in that their traditional news reaches 50 and up, this is really targeted under 50. So they can own the best of both worlds. Take example, CNN. They have their CNN primary product, which skews older. Right. Imagine if they had another CNN that was doing this. They'd have everybody from 18 to 90.
Yeah.
And another important thing about this, it's very even, but it's not vanilla even. In other words, we don't avoid rough topics. But take gun control. We might have Ted Nugent and Barbara Streisand talking for a minute about it. You know, you decide. Instead of being pro or anti. And that's very important, too. And some people say, well, you have to be right or left. No, there's a huge common sense mainstream.
Absolutely. I've been talking about one of the premises I've been doing lately in my show is I just say, can I just be the guy in the middle? Can I be the guy that believes in a little bit of what you believe in over here, maybe on the right? But I'm not the devil to you, because I don't believe in 100% of what you believe in. And I believe in a little bit of what you believe in here or on the left, but not the devil to you. And then I have some of my own opinions, because life lives in the gray areas, the nuance. It's easy to live in black and white. That's for not very sophisticated thinkers, in my opinion. To me, you know, you could, you know, two things could coexist at the same time. You could be pro-gun, but not pro-life, right? So, like, and so when I say just the premise, I just say, can I just be the guy in the middle, be a little bit, they start applauding, which tells me no better test audience than comedy club audience, because they're just in there and they're people from all socioeconomic strata. So if you want to do a survey, that tells me most people are decent, don't want to be divisive, actually do want to try to understand the other side. But the loudest voices get the most attention, and that's the problem right now. So this is great to hear that yours would be even.
Extreme right, extreme left. No, it's that middle ground. It's almost a common sense approach.
And yeah. You
know, like, there's some things personally on the right I'm really into. Other things on the left I'm really into. But it's that middle ground, that common sense area that the channel's going to focus on.
Yeah. We should do this again because there's a whole bunch of other stuff I want to talk to you about just how you went in and Tribune TV stations and newspapers and restructuring and how you did that and how you get people who are entrenched. You seem to be good at getting people who are entrenched in doing things a certain way to get out of their own way and maybe try something new. And just for a second, tell me, like, how do you do that? Because that is so hard, especially if someone seems to be successful at what they're doing, or at least in their own mind, they're successful. It's like, well, why am I doing this, Lee? This has been working. It's fine. And you seem to be able to get people to sort of take a turn. How do you do that?
Well, the first thing is finding the right person at the company. Because there are some people who are at companies who are almost practically paid to say, no, we're not interested. It's risky.
Right.
Not an idea.
Yeah.
Find that one person, and most companies have one, who's high up, who can make a decision. And then you just pitch them and keep on it and more evidence. And sometimes it's just wearing them down until they say, okay. Once you get one and it succeeds, like in radio, they're all sheep. They'll just fall in line.
Yeah.
But it takes that first one. And it's not easy. I've talked to so many people. Some really get it. Some kind of get it. Others like, no, this is too weird. We're happy with
what Yeah.
But it's finding the right person and consistency, just staying on them and hoping they say yes.
Yeah.
But first one's what counts. You get one success and everybody says, well, we went in on that.
Or like you say, it's just you wear them down. Like I would wear my parents down to let me go do something. And they're like, oh, it's Lee again. Oh, Christ. All right. Just tell him yes. Just so he doesn't call anymore. Lee, okay, for God's sake, what do you want me to do? You want me to completely fire the thing and redo it? Yeah, no, people, it's an amazing ability that you have to be able to do that across all of these different mediums. That's the thing that, you know, when I really started to learn more about you and we become, you know, friends recently, like, it's like, wow, this is somebody that really has played the landscape of medium, and it's really impressive. What can people, is there anybody that we can direct people to in terms of what you're doing right now? Any website, any?
Yeah. Lee Abrams, LEEABRAMS.rocks, ROCKS is my website. And it's got a lot of stuff on it. So it's,
does. Trust me. Trust me. It's not like two pictures and a three paragraph bio.
There's a little navigation bar you can
you made me work my ass off. There was a lot of stuff to go through, but I got through it now. But this has been great, and this is why I love to be able to do the podcast, is because I think it's important for the shows to expose people to people that they may not know that they should know,
right,
in terms of what, not just that they've done and the influence that you've had on people lately. You'll never meet them. They'll never meet you, but just all these mediums that you've worked in, but also, you know, you're always a forward thinker. And now this reimagination of news, for example, if this happens in the next year or two, they can say, I remember hearing the guy who created this or whatever. So I'm really glad that we got you on, because I think that it's important for shows like this to kind of, you know, certainly give people what they know or like, but also give them things that they don't know or people they don't know that they should know. So I'm really happy that you were able to come.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Lee Abrams, LeeAbrams.rocks. And really great stuff there. Great newsletter too. And it's great to have you on, my friend.
Thank you. I really appreciate it and had a great time.
All right. There you go. Lee Abrams. Hope you enjoyed it. Great guy. If you are
you know, reading anything, listening to anything, watching anything, he's done something that influenced you in what you're looking at. Anyway, listen, come see me do stand-up. Come see my Broadway show. All the dates are on my website. I'm going to be in New Jersey. I'm going to be in Orlando. I'm going to be in Skokie. I'm going to be in Pennsylvania. I'm going to be in Rhode Island and more. So Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm going to be in Kansas City. So come on out. Go to paulmercurio.com for tickets and information. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.